You think that
now.
our music sounds like that? Like that saying
That's what it
banana?
sounds like.
Banana.
Ba-na-na-na. Ba-na-na-na. Yeah.
Ghost hunting in New England.
Your favorite spooky podcast.
See, folks, it definitely was us doing that. And I think we did it on
I
like,
have.
it was only like the third or fourth try that we did it, that we got it
I was
like.
just gonna say, I somewhere on my computer, I have the recordings of us being like, "Ghost hunting in New England, my favorite spooky podcast." Ghost hunting in New England, my favorite spooky podcast.
Oh, yeah, we tried it in all sorts of voices.
All different ways, yeah.
No, but it came out good. Ghost hunting in New England.
Your favorite spooky podcast. Hello and happy Wednesday. Welcome to this week's episode of Ghost Hunting in New England with your hosts, Amelia.
And Beth.
And what are we talking about today, Beth?
So Amelia and I thought that this week, based on Patriots Day, we would do Ghosts of the American Revolution.
Yeah, but then I kind of screwed it all up.
Not really.
So what happened is Beth had her stories and I like half read it. And then I went out shopping and I did a lot of stuff and I kind of forgot. And then I wrote a whole lot about a place Beth had already written about. And by the time I realized, it was too late.
So Amelia's going to talk about that place. Because I have another fun place to talk about.
Beth did the work. I didn't.
That's all right.
Okay. Do you want to start or do you want me to start?
Oh, I want you to start because you're going to talk about New England. And I think that I have a really jam-packed story to finish up with.
I'm going to talk about this house. It's called the Hooper Lee Nichols House, and it's in 159 Brattle Street in Cambridge, which is in Harvard Square. Now, I have some information about how this house is haunted. Some of it relates to the Revolutionary War, some of it does not. And then I went down the rabbit hole. And in my searching, I found on in my reading, I discovered, which I had already known, I didn't know it was at this house. I did know about this murder, a very big murder in
Gruesome.
Boston. Gruesome, if you will.
Gruesome.
So
Very
I did
Dr.
a lot of,
Frankenstein.
I did a lot about the murder, but it has nothing to do with the Revolutionary War and nothing
Does
to
it
do with
have to
Patriots.
do with a haunted location that has been around since the Revolutionary War and may have other revolutionary leftovers hanging around? All
Yes, and
right.
that's why I included it. But it's really it's just an aside. It's I found it interesting. It's an aside.
I'll be the decision maker on what's an aside and what's not. Go ahead.
Okay, built in 1685, the Hooper Lee Nichols House is the second oldest house in Cambridge. The house was initially built for the prominent Cambridge physician Richard Hooper. Unfortunately, Dr. Hooper passed away in 1691. Once Dr. Hooper passed on, his wife, Elizabeth Hooper, was faced with severe financial troubles. And no one's really sure why. And that's actually part of the mystery here. He was a pretty prominent doctor, and it was really unusual and kind of talked about how he died and his wife was broke. Like there was nothing. But she did have this house.
So while you're figuring it out, I just want to point out that it wouldn't have been unlikely for him to, one, actually have had nothing and just have lived a high style kind of lifestyle and then left her in debt at the end. Or two, because she's a woman and she can't control her own finances, one of his brothers or something could have just stepped in and stolen the money. And there would
No.
have been nothing she could have done about it.
So that was not it, because in a lot of my research, it said part of like the mystery of him and this house is why she was so like he just died totally broke, even though he was this prominent doctor. So anyway,
Maybe
she.
he liked the opium or the lanimum, whatever they were calling it those days.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because she ended up converting her home into a tavern and started also taking boarders. And there was definitely some funny business going on. So was it drugs, opium? I don't know. Was opium in America in the 1600s? I have no idea. I was thinking maybe it could have been prostitutes. It could have been gambling. It could have been a lot of different things.
It was a house of ill repute.
Indeed. Indeed. And it got it, that was the reputation. It was just filthy. It was really embarrassing for her and just for the neighborhood. So in 1701, the house, like the interior especially, was pretty much destroyed by lodgers and people in the tavern. It was really disgusting and yucky. What was really yucky about the house is the fact that she was dead in it and wrapped in a white sheet. So that's really gross. And no one knows what happened to her. You know, this is 16, what is this? No, this is 1701. So there's not a lot of forensic stuff going on or autopsies. So no one knows if she died of an illness and someone just wrapped her up, or if she was murdered and someone wrapped her up. But it's kind of a unique woman in white because people still see her walking around everywhere, but she's wrapped up in a sheet, the same one she died in. So it's kind of sad and it's kind of gross. So during the pre-revolutionary era, the house was owned by Joseph Lee, who purchased the property in 1758. Lee was a Harvard graduate who made his fortune as a merchant and a land speculator. Although he was denied re-election to the Massachusetts House of Representatives in 1766 and rejected as unfit from a permanent appointment at the Court of Common Pleas in 1769, Judge Lee was chosen by the English Crown to serve on the Mendemus Council, a royal governing body that was usurped power from the local government as a condition of the 1774 Course of Acts. Okay, so in 1774, when Gage's mission to legally withdraw the colony's gunpowder stores from Charleston Powder House went awry, an angry mob of 4,000 provincials. Yeah, see, that's the word you can correct me on. I don't know that one. Gathered on Cambridge Common to protest the indecent and intolerable acts themselves. Armed with only sticks, the frustrated colonists marched down Brattle Street, demanding the resignation of the Cambridge members of the Mendemus Council, including Joseph Lee. Giving into demands of the mob, Lee resigned from his post almost immediately and soon fled Cambridge with the other loyalists of Tory row. In 1777, Lee returned to Cambridge and demanded his property back. The siege of Boston that had ended the March of 1776 marked the end of the Continental Army's occupation of Cambridge, and Lee's estate was returned to his care. So while Lee was in charge, he would sometimes rent out rooms in his house to soldiers. I don't know. Would he rent out the rooms or would he just let them stay there? I don't know. But he would do that. And so legend has it, a group of five Hessian soldiers, German soldiers employed by the British during the American Revolution, haunt the Huber Lee Nichols house. According to several accounts, the fierce European ghosts are often caught playing cards together in the library. It's believed that the soldiers were buried near the home sometime during the conflict. The Hessian spirits are said to have emerged in 1915 after a library was constructed over their final resting place. In 1850, the house was rented to George and Susan Nichols, who performed some of the most extensive renovations ever made to the building, which I thought was kind of weird that you would rent a house to someone and that they would do all the renovations.
In lieu of paying rent, that's pretty normal.
I don't know if that was it, though.
I wasn't there. I don't know either.
Me either. I used to live right near here, though. I lived right around the corner from this place for a long time. And yeah, I knew none of this history. So the Nichols were celebrating the 4th of July in their new residence. And they're showcasing their remodeling and showing everyone all the nice work they've done. And their granddaughter came in, stepped on a lit firework. Ouch. So the open wound became very infected and she passed away. Sometimes I read it. So most of the accounts said she stepped on it. Some said she burned it with her hand. So
the thing that I read said that she stepped on a big display of fireworks.
Yeah, I don't know. A few places said like the cuts were in her hand. Maybe it exploded in her, hit her hand. I don't know. Did you ever watch what's that show with George Clooney? Hospital.
ER?
Yes. Okay. There was, whenever I think of fireworks, I think of this. There was an episode. It's the only episode I ever saw where this guy comes in and he's like, oh, I burned my hand off with fireworks, but Anyway.
Was it really crystal meth?
Yes. Because there's some other case going on in the city. And then the doctors come in, they're like, there aren't any yards in Ulston. Oh, no, he didn't say he burnt. You know, he said got caught in a lawnmower or something. All right. I guess that was irrelevant to what we're talking about. It took me a minute to get there. Okay. Anywho, so from then on, the spirit of the Nichols' granddaughter has been haunting the house. And she likes to move objects from one place to another. And some people report hearing her crying. And it sounds like a little girl crying, and I think it's her because she exploded.
Don't play with fireworks, kids.
Do you want to hear the story about the murder?
Well, I already know the story about the murder because you might remember I also did this research, but I assume that our listeners want to hear.
Yeah, it's cool. You can also hear about this murder on My Favorite Murder, which is another podcast, arguably a better one than ours. Beth doesn't like it, but I like it.
And you know why I don't like it? They curse too much.
I know. I was going to say.
That's literally the only reason. I can't listen to it because every other word is an F-bomb. And it makes me not want to listen.
A podcast of ill repute.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I used to be like the biggest murderino in the world, but I don't know. It's not doing it for me anymore these days. But I like it sometimes. Okay. So in 1849, Dr. John White Webster rented the Hooper Lee Nichols house. Born in Boston, Massachusetts, Webster was from a well-connected family. He graduated from Harvard College in 1811, and in 1814, he was among the founders of the Linnean Society of New England, which we will all remember what a Linnean Society is because Beth brought it up in her, was it the Gloucester episode? And that is a society of people who name things. So he was appointed cabinet keeper of the society, quickly growing collection of specimens in the Joyce Buildings of Boston. He graduated from Harvard Medical in 1815, which is kind of funny that just didn't take that long. After that, he went to London for a bit and to the Azores, where he practiced medicine, finished his first book, and met the daughter of the American Vice Consul on the island, Harriet Frederica Hickling. I kind of like that name, Hickling.
Frederica.
Alote. Okay. So they get married and he has four daughters. He moved the family back to Boston. He entered a private medical practice, but the lack of success prompted him to change careers. Webster was elected a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 1823. In 1824, he was appointed a lecturer of chemistry, mineralogy, geology at Harvard Medical. Webster was a popular lecturer. Many of his classroom demonstrations involved some of the latest chemical discoveries, and many of them also were livened by pyrotechnic drama, although the president of Harvard warned that some of them were dangerous if an accident occurred. But he really wasn't a dangerous guy. He wasn't like a crazy coot.
Right.
Reports written
there was no reason that anyone would have been worried about him or nervous about him at all.
Exactly. So after his trial, they kind of like, which I guess we haven't gotten into what he did, but after his trial, they criticized his teaching abilities and said people tolerated rather than respected him. And he's only retained his position on account of his comparative insignificance. As a lecturer, he was dull and commonplace. While students took tickets to his lectures, they did not generally attend them.
So he was lecturing to a big empty hall.
Burn. He also had financial problems. Big financial problems. The family had been forced to give up the mansion he built in Cambridge, and he was in debt. This forced him to move to the Hooper Lee Nichols house in 1849. George Parkman was a Boston. This is a different guy now. We're talking about someone else. George Parkman was a Boston businessman belonging to one of the city's richest families. He is a well-known figure in the streets of Boston, which he walked daily collecting his rent. He was tall and lean with a protruding chin and wore a top hat. He would walk because he was cheap and didn't want to buy a horse. Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. said that he abstained while others indulged. He walked while others rode. He worked while others slept. Fanny Longfellow, wife of poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, called him the lean doctor, the good-natured Don Quixote. He was worth some $500,000 in 1849, which would be how much now, Beth?
$1.5 billion.
$100 billion.
$10 million. Webster first borrowed $400, equivalent to approximately $11,000, from Parkman in 1842. In 1847, aka 5 years later, he had little of this repaid, and he gave Parkman a note for $2,432, about $66,000 in today's money, which represented the unpaid balance and a further loan. This was secured by a mortgage of Webster's personal property, including a cabinet of minerals. In 1848, still in distress, he borrowed $1,200 from Robert G. Shaw, making over to him as collateral the minerals that already stood as collateral to Parkman's loan. This enraged Parkman, who sought out Webster for confrontation.
Were they going to have a duel?
No. Much more sinister. So on November 22nd, a week before Thanksgiving, Parkman went to Cambridge to look for Webster. And he actually went to the school and insisted that the school start paying him Webster's paychecks. So the school would like write over Webster's paychecks to Parkman. And
that's actually not like a completely crazy idea. We do that with stuff all the time now. When you get like a lien put against your paycheck, or if you have to pay like court ordered child support, they just take it right out of your paycheck and they write a check to somebody else instead. So even though I'm making that face about like, wow, that's really awful, like actually they do that a lot.
I only ever heard, I guess, child support, that makes sense, but I know they do it for taxes.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like if you have a judgment against you for like negligence or something, you know, like they attach your paycheck for the rest of your life. And like every week for the rest of your life, you send $25 to that person.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd never heard that.
Oh, yeah. That's why you have to have good insurance, especially if it's found to be not an accident, but it was actually negligence and you can be found liable for that. Like then suddenly the damages go way higher. This and other legal advice on next week's podcast.
That when I first went to a financial advisor, that's the first thing they said. Insurance up. Okay. So Webster visited Parkman at his home and suggested they meet at the medical college that afternoon at around 1:30 p.m. At 1:45, the last confirmed sighting of Parkman had him entering the college on North Grove Street wearing a dark frock coat, dark trousers, a purple satin vest, and a stovepipe hat.
Frosty the Snowman,
you know,
was a jolly happy soul.
When I think of this guy, I just think of my landlord over at my shop. And if it was like at all acceptable, I think he'd wear a top hat around. I do. I'm sure there was a point in his life where he wore top hats.
Wear like a monocle, like Mr. Peanut, and carry a cane?
I do. Yes. Oh, I think if he would be allowed, he would. There later that afternoon, Littlefield, who is, I guess I did, I cut a lot out of this story. Littlefield is a janitor who works in the area. He works at the college. He like lives under the lab or something. And he's kind of always around.
Custodian. He's a custodian.
How's that different than a janitor?
Connotative meaning. Like there are certain words that we don't use anymore. Like we don't say stewardess. We say flight attendant.
People still say janitor.
Being the child of someone who was a custodian, some of us are a little sensitive about
janitor
versus custodian. Sounds more sophisticated.
Okay. So later that afternoon, Littlefield found Webster's room locked, who was the custodian. Littlefield was the custodian and he lived there. And he found Webster's room locked from the inside and heard water running. Webster showed back at his house at 6 p.m.
Wait a second. 1850. Do we have indoor plumbing in 1850? Or might the sound of that water running have been someone peeing in a bucket?
Or blood gushing out somewhere.
Ooh, yeah. Pouring blood. Yeah. If you had like the body hung up like you would do with like a cow after you killed it and like drain all the blood out the neck.
Yeah.
Amelia being a vegan, I can only imagine that was a very unsettling mental image. Sorry about that.
Amelia watches so much crime TV. that if you think that idea, no, doesn't even.
No, but it makes me
and
sad.
And my slasher
like
films.
It makes me sad that animals die. But I enjoy a good steak, so.
I get sad about the animals, too. Okay, so on November 24th, Parkman's family made anxious inquiries and contacted the police. Later that day, Little Phil, the custodian, saw Webster, the guy who killed him, with a bundle. That's an old-timey word for some money. Webster told him to make a fire. On November 25th, Webster appeared outside the college where he met Parkman's nephew, James Henry Blake, and a police officer named Trenholm. They asked him if he had seen Parkman. That afternoon, he also visited Parkman's brother, the Reverend Francis Parkman, and informed him and his family that he had met the missing man after obtaining $483.64 to pay a debt installment, and later promised that he would go right away to have the payment recorded at the city clerk to clear out the debt. Webster then left without inquiring about the search. So it was like, they're like, hey, have you seen this guy? And he's like, oh, no, I paid him some money. And then I had to go and record how much money I paid him. See you later, pal. And wasn't like, no, why are you asking me? Is he missing? Like, that's why in law enforcement.
All very sketchy.
You look for the questions people ask and you look for the ones they don't ask too, you know?
Methinks thou doth protest too much.
Duh. Okay, so now we go to November 26th, and with a $3,000 reward settled on finding Parkman alive, what are you doing? Why don't you listen to me talk anymore?
I am listening to you. I was converting money in my mind. A $300 reward then, or was it $3,000?
It was a $3,000
reward. So that was like $100,000 in today's money. There was a lot of money out there. Because I remember earlier you said that they borrowed $400, and that was the equivalent of $11,000, so...
$3,000 reward settled for finding Parkman alive. The family had 28,000 copies of a wanted notice printed up, posted, and distributed. A little later, $1,000 reward was offered if you found his body. Still a lot of money. Mm-hmm. On November 27th, Webster worked at the college in the evening. Littlefield, the custodian, started to get really nervous because a lot of people were asking him questions and like implying he had something to do with the disappearance. And he was also getting nervous because now Webster, his his boss, is acting very odd, just being an odd duck. So a few days after the murder, the two men met in the street and Webster asked the custodian if he had seen Parkman at the college the previous week. Little Phil said he had on Friday around 1:30, and Webster struck his cane on the ground, asking him if he had seen Parkman anywhere in the building, had seen him after 1:30, or if Parkman had been in Webster's own lecture room. When Little Phil answered no to these questions, Webster repeated the story about paying off the debt and then walked off. And it is said that that conversation was the most he had ever spoken to Littlefeld, who had been working for him for quite some time.
Establishing an alibi.
Indeed. So in court, Littlefeld also said that 4 days prior to the murder, Webster asked him a number of questions about the dissecting vault. And after the college had been searched, the professor surprised him with a turkey for a Thanksgiving dinner. And he had never given him anything before. So it was like this weird stuff happens. And then he's like, oh, by the way, friend, here's a big turkey for you and your family, pal.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Yeah, I didn't kill that guy. Okay, so then now we're on to Thanksgiving. I took so much of the story out. There's so much more, but it's still just a long story. Littlefield borrowed a hatch, a drill, a crowbar, and a mortal chisel, and with his wife standing guard, began chiseling away the wall under Webster's private lab. He went down a tunnel into the vault where the wall felt really hot, and he had been hacking at it for a while, and he had to like keep stopping. Like he'd go, and then he'd have to go to a dance, and he'd go, and he'd have to come back. So,
I'm sorry, he had to go to a dance?
Yeah, that's right.
Like he had to stop and like go to a ball.
Yeah, that's right. It was a hoedown.
Nah, something sounds fishy right there.
Maybe it was a dance at the college and he had to clean up after them.
That makes more sense than having to attend some sort of dance as a guest.
It said he stopped to go to a dance.
He stopped to go to a dance.
All right. So on November 30th, Littlefield resumed chiseling and worked for some time until he managed to punch a hole into a wall, at which point he felt a strong draft that did not permit his lantern to stay lit inside. Spooky. While he was maneuvering it, he looked around, ignoring foul fumes and letting his eyes adjust to the dark. And then he saw something that really struck a nerve with him. He made out that on top of a mound of dirt sitting in the corner was a human pelvis. And then he saw a dismembered thigh and the lower part of a leg sitting at the other end of the room.
Excellent.
So he freaks out and he finds some other professors and gets the cops involved and it's the whole thing. And the investigators are now like fast forward. Now everyone's involved. And they're like, oh, see now, what's this? So now they're like, where the hell's the rest of the body? So what happened is he found a bone fragment in a furnace in the laboratory to which Webster had access to. A full search of the toilet areas were conducted and Webster was brought in from the jail to observe them cleaning. And while the officers and coroner were searching, Littlefield showed them a piece of the furnace that he had broken off, and on it there was a bone fused to the side of it. They insisted he put it back exactly where they found it, and Webster watched silently as they laid out all the parts of the body that they did find. And then they took his butt back to jail. So on December 1st, a coroner's jury was assembled to make a judgment about the disposition of the case. And before they were let in, the coroner and Marshall's men examined a sink that appeared to be recently gouged in several places, the strange acid stains on the floor and steps, and the contents of the furnace, which they actually found the jawbone in. They dumped everything out from the chest, and there was a lot of like yucky smells in this chest. And there was an armless, headless, hairy, and partly burned torso in it. Just as they determined that the head had been sawn off, they found a saw nearby. Then they found a thigh stuffed inside of the torso, and the heart and other organs were missing. Mrs. Parkman identified the body as her husband's from markings near the penis and on the lower back. Ugh. Oh, thank you. Oy vey.
And they say that women in that time weren't really, you know, paying much attention.
Hey, you only have one to look at. You're going to remember it. His brother-in-law said that he had seen the extreme hairiness of Parkman's body and confirmed that the body was his. Subsequent searches turned up bloody clothing belonging to Webster, as well as the right kidney. Testing on stains showed them to be a copper nitrate, a substance effective for removing blood. And Jeffries Wyman arrived to identify the bone fragments. Since they were already at a medical college with good facilities for examination of a body, they laid out the parts and tested them and wrote up thorough descriptions. They conjectured that a hole found underneath the left breast might have been a stab that killed the victim, although it did not resemble a wound and there was no blood. By the end of the day, they had estimated the man's height to be 5'10", a match to George Parkman. On December 6th, thousands of people lined the streets for Parkman's funeral and 5,000 people toured the crime scene. Isn't that wild? This is like 6 days after they found him. 5,000 people are walking through.
5,000 people toured the crime scene.
Mm-hmm. Following a tiresome 12-day-long trial, Webster confessed to murdering George Parkman in a fit of rage and was executed in August 1850. Many people believe that Dr. Webster was framed by the janitor who found the body, and especially because I guess the janitor or the custodian had a lot of like bad stuff going on in his life and like didn't, I don't know, he just like wasn't a happy person. And he had like been convicted of like crimes in the past. And also it was like, it's a Harvard doctor. Like how could he, with four daughters and like he was in debt, but like, why would he kill someone? So there's some other interesting things about this story, which is like one of the first like instances of like kind of like forensics as we see it being used, like how they were able to tell like what kind of acid was used and all that other stuff. Interesting, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did Littlefield collect any of the reward having been the person that found the body?
He did. He retired handsomely.
Nice. All right.
Yeah, he collected the $1,000.
So Do you think that there's any chance whatsoever that when Dr. Webster was living in the house that's now the Cambridge Historical Society, that maybe the ghosts that were living in there possibly drove him crazy and he then had to murder Dr. Parkman?
No, I think he was in like a ton of debt and he was smelling all these kinds of crazy chemicals all day.
Work with me here. I'm trying to connect it back to your haunted house.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So what do you think? Maybe, is it possible?
Yes, it was the German soldiers who made him do it.
Well, the German soldiers didn't show up until 75 years later.
Incorrect.
The
German soldiers were there for the Revolutionary War, and this happened in 1850.
When did the Hessian soldiers, when did they start being noticed? When the addition of the library was added.
Yeah, but they were still there. That's just when people noticed them.
But they weren't there before. That was the point.
Yes, they were.
They only started showing up because the ground where they had been buried was dug up and they were disturbed.
Nah.
Yeah.
Speculation. Speculation overruled.
Well, perhaps young Miss Nichols with her firecracker feet. Maybe she was the thing that drove him to do it.
Esther Lee.
Or Esther Lee. Yeah. Oh, that was the girl's name?
That was the woman who was rolled up in the sheet.
That was Elizabeth Hooper.
Her.
So yes, maybe it was Elizabeth Hooper, but I'm more inclined to think that it was young Miss Nichols, and perhaps Dr. Webster was just looking to figure out, you know, like, if I blow this body up, what's going to happen to it?
Maybe.
See? I told you it wasn't a complete waste of time.
My mom had a friend whose husband put her in a vat of acid.
Yeah.
And that was another interesting. Before? Probably. It like haunts me. I think about it all the time.
Oh, maybe I edited that out. Maybe not. I don't remember. But I remember talking about this before because it was completely horrifying.
Yeah, it's really upsetting.
A nobody crime. So good story.
Thanks.
So if I wanted to visit the Hooper Lee Nichols house, can I visit it?
Yes. It's on Brattle Street. I already said that.
So it's currently the Cambridge Historical Society. It was actually donated to them in 1957, and it is open for tours. You can go in. It's a minimal entry fee. But even more than that, you can actually rent out the whole house for a variety of different functions. So, I mean, you can't rent like the office spaces of the Historical Society, but they have places in there that you can rent out for like 40, I think it was to like 100 people.
Did you know that, remember when we used to record in Somerville?
I do remember when we used to record in Somerville.
There's a guy on the board of directors there, and his name is Sam Beltruce, and he's written like 1,000 books on hauntings, and he's coming out with a book, and he wrote about this place too in his book. I haven't read it yet. I don't think it's out yet. I think it's out at the end of the month, but it's on the American Ghosts of the American Revolution.
Really?
Yep. It comes out this month.
That's funny because I saw his name in my research as well. I can't remember if it was talking about the Hooper Lee Nichols or the other place.
Yeah, we should get him. We should get him on the show.
Okay. Want to move on? So our next story, dear listeners, is about Fort Mifflin in just outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It is called by some the Fort That Saved America. So it was built by the British in 1771. They gave over control of it somehow to the American colonists by the beginning of the Revolutionary War. It actually holds a unique distinction as being one of the few forts that has served in multiple conflicts. So it was part of the Revolutionary War, and then it was part of the Civil War, and then it was even stationed again during World War II to defend the homeland in the 1940s, which I thought was fascinating. So it's right at the mouth of the Delaware River. So in order for any ships to get into Philadelphia itself, they have to come past this fort. And it's a small fort. It's not one of like the big, huge forts that you would think about, but it's got some history and it's got some fun stuff. In November of 17-
I have a question. Where is it again? What town?
It's just outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Do you know what town?
Philadelphia.
Is it in Philadelphia or is it outside of Philadelphia?
I believe it is actually part of Philadelphia itself.
Okay. Philadelphia is really big. And like, you know how Boston has like the Financial District, but then it has like Oak Square? But like it's still Boston?
You mean like it has Southie and Roxbury?
Yeah.
And Back Bay. And those are all different neighborhoods within Boston? Yes.
Yes. That's what I'm saying. That's my point. Philadelphia is like that, but it's a lot bigger.
Yeah. Much, much bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can't walk around Philly like you can walk around Boston.
No.
So in November of 1777, the British attacked Fort Mifflin. George Washington was very close by at the time, and they had this battle going on. It was considered to be the greatest sea battle of the American Revolution. Amelia has just put on her Prada sunglasses, by the way. So the British obviously had the greatest navy in the entire world at that point, and so they were coming at and just bombarding this little fort. There were over 300 American men killed in action or wounded. And the battle here, now, when you think of a battle, Amelia, how long do you think that it lasts?
An hour.
I'm kind of thinking the same thing, that like, you know, like at the end of the hour, like who's left, right? Have we decided who's won, right? Maybe you might take a day or two, or, you know, like you hear about the, you know, the battle at Gettysburg, you know, like that was a 3-day battle. This battle went on for 60 days. That's 2 months.
It's too long.
At one point, the British were bombarding the fort with so many cannonballs that it was estimated to be up to 1,000 cannonballs every 20 minutes. Like, that's just outrageous. And so, needless to say, a lot of people died there.
You would get so strong.
Having to load all those cannonballs?
Yeah.
They were probably strong before that. But
how much do you think a cannonball weighs?
I think it depends on if it's like a 10 or 25 or 50 pound ball.
So you think between like 10 and 55 pounds?
Well, I think that they're all kind of like standard manufactured, right? So they're all meant to weigh.
Were they back then? I don't know. Did they have to make them all by hand?
Google. No, oh, I'm just kidding. I don't have one of those things that listens to me all day long.
Okay, Google. How big is a cannonball? Thanks, Google. They're 8 to 10 pounds.
8 to 10 pounds. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's like lifting a gallon of milk.
Yeah, you'd get really strong.
All right. Anyway, so like I said, 300 men died during this attack. George Washington had actually been very close by on site, and he withdrew with the vast majority of the troops. And he told the people who were staying that they were to defend the fort to the last. Right. So they were not to give up the fort under any circumstances. They were to basically, like, you're going to keep firing until you die. And that's it. And so George Washington took off with the forces. And that's when he went to Valley Forge and wintered over to prepare for the following spring. Hi, George Washington. Bye, George Washington. We're not going to talk about him anymore. So there was just this massive battle that went on there at the fort. It was rebuilt afterwards in the late 1700s because it had clearly just been annihilated. Right? All those cannonballs coming at it. And it was used in the War of 1812. It was used as a prison during the Civil War. And like I said, it was just a safety precaution during World War II. I didn't write a script this week, so I'm actually doing this right off the top of my head. So far, so good. You can actually visit this place, right? And not only that, but if you happen to be like a school or something, like you can take like educational tours out there, and just wait until I get to the end to tell you about some of the tours you can do, Amelia. It's pretty neat. All right. So the number one ghost that is seen at Fort Mifflin is the screaming lady, Elizabeth Pratt. Okay. She is the person who is most seen by the visitors. She had been the wife of one of the early commanders of the fort. And so she was the wife of an officer. She found out that her daughter was going to marry, gasp, an enlisted man, right? Not an officer, which apparently is a big deal. I don't know. I was never in the service, so I really don't understand all of those things. But anyway, so she disowns her daughter, right? Like, get out, leave here. You're no longer part of my family. And then the daughter catches dysentery and dies. And when Elizabeth heard that her daughter had died, she was so overcome with guilt and with remorse that she didn't reconcile with her daughter before she died, that she just collapsed in this big screaming fit, right? And
I don't blame her.
Well, yeah. And over the next year or so, she just descended deeper and deeper into that guilt and depression, and she ended up killing herself. Within a year of her daughter's death. So now people see her at the fort. She is most often seen by little kids. She kind of hangs out in the officers' quarters, which are up on the second floor, and little kids all the time will ask, who is that woman up in the windows by the officers' quarters? She dresses in 17th century period garb. So she's, you know, dressed in like old style clothing. And so she kind of catches attention, even in a place where everybody walks around in costume. Right. So I think that that's really interesting that these kids are all picking out this woman up in the rafters. She also has a tendency to scream point that neighbors of the fort, which doesn't, I kind of wonder about this because if it's a fort on an island, who the hell are these neighbors? But anyway, neighbors, or maybe they're just employees or, you know, somebody there has called the police.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Could it be like, isn't it if you work at Plymouth Plantation, don't they live there?
No, they go home.
What?
I think that the Wampanoags who live there also like show like demonstrations, but I don't think that the actors and that who are part of like the settlement live there. Although in all fairness, I've never met somebody who worked as
an
actor.
That's my point.
Plymouth or Sturbridge, but I imagine they have to be like, you know, real people.
Yeah, they're real people, but I always just assumed they had like dorms there or something.
Well, so like if I wanted to live there or if I wanted to work there, like I don't imagine they would also let Sean and Bobby live there.
I think they would.
I don't know.
I think you'd all work there.
Mm. Yeah, but what if they don't want to work there? Why should I be stopped from being an early colonist just because my husband wants to run a liquor store?
I don't know.
Anyway, so police have been called repeatedly because people hear someone screaming and they think that a woman is actually like in danger and being hurt. So, mm-hmm. And then the police show up and obviously there's nothing there. But so she is the most frequently seen specter, if you will. Out on the parade grounds, there are often seen Confederate or Union soldiers just all lined up, marching together in step. And one of the really interesting things about these particular specters is that they're kind of like pale and translucent. And you would think that they were just like an overactive imagination, or they were just, you know, like something that you shouldn't have taken notice of, except they're seen all the time.
Wild.
All right. Then we have this guy known as Edward. I don't know why he's named Edward. My twin nieces, it's kind of a really long story, but one of them played a really long game in order to steal a stuffed rhinoceros from daycare, which it's kind of a funny story, but I'll tell you later. But the really funny part of it is that for some reason they decided that, and this is the twins, they're 3 and a half, decided that this purloined rhino's name is Ed. And so nobody can figure out why the rhino's name is Ed, because one of my brother's names is Ed. So why would they have named the rhino after Uncle Ed? It's just a strange thing. Anyway, so Edward, right, is just this guy's name. And one of the caretakers at the fort outside of her office.
Would that be an aside, Beth?
That's very much an aside. One of the caretakers outside of her office, there will just appear out of nowhere this cot with this pale, sickly looking man who just lays there. Occasionally he moans and looks at her, and then he kind of disappears. But he shows up all the time. So apparently her office is right where like the infirmary used to be. Then there's the lamplighter. And this is believed to be John Adkins. He walks around the second floor porch lighting the lamps at night. And so people will feel his presence. They feel a warmth. They feel like all of a sudden it's a little bit lighter after he goes by. Like, not like heavy, like the air is heavy, but like they can suddenly see a little bit better after his presence goes by, as though he has lit the lamps on his way past. So I thought that was really neat. They have another guy. Oh, there are a ton of ghosts at this place. Like, there are more than we could possibly talk about. Jacob Sawyer, S-A-U-E-R. Sar, so it'd be, let's see, from 24 is Jack Bauer, so Sour, I guess is how you would say this. Sure.
It is, yeah.
Anyway, Jacob Sour, he was a blacksmith back in the day, and he had his own little blacksmith hut there on the grounds. He was a civilian, but it seems that he has hung around because people routinely report hearing that rhythmic clashing of the hammer on the anvil, right, like the clang, clang, clang. And then when they go over to look into the little building where the noise is coming from, nobody's in there. There's no noise. It happens all the time. The warden's house, which was on the parade grounds where they often see the Confederate soldier kind of see-through apparitions, the warden's house burned down sometime in the 1900s. And ever since then, there are these random bells that ring.
Wow.
Out of nowhere. There are no bells left at the fort, except the ones that used to be in the warden's house that are now gone. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, people will hear the ringing of bells.
Ba-na-na, 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 da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na.
How about...
It's ringing of the bells.
Very nice. By the Trans-Siberian Orchestra?
Yes, yes.
How about the Faceless Man? Would you like to hear about the Faceless Man?
Sure.
All right. So the Faceless Man is believed to be William Howe. He was a soldier. He was a British soldier. He killed his commanding officer and fled. And he was charged with obviously killing this commanding officer, as well as desertion during wartime. And so he was dragged back and kept imprisoned in the Fort Mifflin. He was hanged, right? So before they would bring somebody out and hang them, they would, you know, we've all seen it on TV. They put the black bag over the head.
Yes.
So when his outline appears now, the shadow of him, he's very clear and you can see his outline walking around the fort, but you can never see his face. It's always in shadow. And people think that it's because of the bag that would have been over his head before he was executed. So it's just a fabulously fun story. So anyway, Fort Mifflin, just outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. You can go there on educational tours. You can go there for all sorts of things. You can be just a visitor and show up for the day. I think it's like $5 to get in. And Amelia, they like totally play up the paranormal aspect. There are all sorts of paranormal tours that you can go on any time of year. In October, they do
special- Any time of year?
Any time of year, yes.
Can I go next month?
Yes. COVID sensitive, of course.
Let me tell you, Pennsylvania, they're not COVID sensitive like we up here in Massachusetts are COVID sensitive.
In October, they have candlelight paranormal tours. You can walk around and
that's
do that.
Fun.
And then they even have a thing called sleeping with ghosts. I would like to do the candlelight paranormal tour. I do not want to do sleeping with ghosts, first of all, because I don't want to sleep in the place. I want to sleep in my own bed. And second of all, because I don't necessarily need to sleep somewhere where there are definitely lots of ghosts. I'm happy to just come and visit them and then leave at the end of the day.
I want to do it.
Yeah.
How much will it cost to do a sleep with ghosts? I'm in Pennsylvania.
It wasn't like a weirdly expensive thing. Hang on. So it's going to be Saturday, October 23rd to Sunday, the 24th. Take a guided tour, learn paranormal techniques. It says actual sleep is optional, advance purchase required, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't have a price.
Dang. If you have to ask, you can't afford it.
What are you, Coco Chanel? yeah.
I'd like to go sleep over. We'll go down to Pennsylvania. We'll do the candlelight tour. Then you can go sleep out at my mother-in-law's. She's fantastic, and she'll make you the most delicious borscht you've ever had. And I will sleep overnight with the ghosts.
Okay, well, hopefully somebody else will stay with you. But so, yeah, they have open investigation evenings. I believe it starts Saturday, March 6th, and that's $45 a person, and it's from 7 p.m. to midnight. The candlelight ghost tours, it doesn't give a time or price on that, but it has Fridays and Saturdays in October. I think that it's definitely a pretty neat thing. You can also do private investigations. So you can do a 6-hour investigation Sunday through Friday, not on Saturdays, from 6 p.m. to midnight, and it's $600 for up to 10 people. Or you can do the overnight investigation, which is from 5 p.m. to 10 a.m., and that's $900 for 10 participants. So you can basically arrive after the fort closes at 4 p.m. and stay until it opens the next morning at 10, which is pretty neat. I mean, I don't think that I'm going to do a sleepover with the ghosts, but I would definitely go and hang out until it was bedtime, go home and come back in the morning.
Let's go.
You're going to find out what the price is. Although apparently it's $900 and we can invite 8 other people. Do you know 8 other people who would be interested in staying all night at a haunted.
We should have a ghost hunting in New England get together. We got listeners down there.
A ghost hunting New England get together only in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, we've got tons of listeners in Pennsylvania. We can make Paul's sister Julia add a few of her friends too if we don't hit eight. Good story, Beth.
Thanks. It wasn't nearly as long as yours, but I feel like this week was good. Just two.
I'd say it was longer than my ghost part of my story.
Okay.
It was not as long as the true crime I decided to add in.
Hey, right. It was tangentially related. What else we got going on? We got any mail? We got any reviews?
Beth, we have so Amelia. Much stuff. And I would like to issue an apology to Tony T. Because on last week's episode, we did not read his review he left us. So we are going to read it right now.
Are we going to do it like choral reading? We're going to do it together?
No. So this is from iTunes. And it says, enjoyable. Just found your podcast and it's one of my favorites. Dry, entertaining stories and your personalities. Stay healthy, Tony T. Thanks so much, Tony T.
Thanks, Tony T.
Now,
next. We love having dry personalities.
No, dry, entertaining stories.
Oh, our stories are dry.
Like dry humor.
I know that's what he means. I know.
Okay, so you might recall last week when we read Spencer's email, I was like, and sometimes it takes a minute for the reviews to show up on Apple. So if you're thinking we're going to read your review, might just not have seen it. And that's because he like wrote his Apple screen name. So I was like, he probably left us a review, but it hadn't showed up yet. But here it is. Now we have it. My favorite podcast.
Woo-hoo!
Found your podcast last September after I moved to Massachusetts from Arizona and have been waiting to go write a review until I was completely caught up. I'm so excited to send in my drive-by ghostings. I've even recommended y'all to a few friends. Love your dynamic and the juxtaposition of Amelia bringing her experience as a Reiki master spiritualist and Beth diving deep into history of locations. Keep up the great work, and I look forward to future episodes.
Woohoo! That review really had everything that I think I could ever want.
It was very nice. It was very nice. Thanks, Spence. That was great.
Yes. And thank you. But so wait, that makes me think, like, is that why we're not getting enough other reviews? Because people are waiting until they get to the end to put in a review? Put your reviews in now, folks. Put your reviews
right
in now.
Right now. Right now. Okay. And then on Monday, we got a review from Dolly319. Great show. Great little spooky podcast. Love to listen.
It's her favorite spooky podcast. Thanks, Dolly.
Thanks, Dolly319. And I think that was it. Let me check. Nope, no new reviews on Audible this week. So that was it. But those are some good reviews. And I am really happy.
Yay.
Tom. Now, we need to also issue a caveat. Because on last week's episode, we were like, oh, we're going to hear from Tom again with more of his creepy stuff my kids say stories. So remember, he said he'd email it every week. But we recorded twice this week.
Tom should have known we were going to do that. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, he didn't. So instead, we have an email from, it's another Amy story. This next story is titled Death Forebodings. There's actually two stories in it. Name just changed in this story. When my children were young, I often got together with a friend, Shirley, who had young children, the younger of whom was named Gabrielle. One day, I was by myself in the kitchen, and the thought crossed my mind that when Gabrielle died, I needed to really be there for Shirley. Gabrielle was her younger son, who at the time was a healthy boy a little over a year old. After I thought that, I chastised myself for thinking something so dark and improbable. Less than a week later, I got a call that Gabrielle had died of
septicemia.
Yes. No one
blood,
had even
blood
realized,
poisoning.
Oh my goodness, that's awful. No one had even realized he was sick. Tragic.
Yeah, that happens when like you get like a little cut that you don't take care of and it just gets infected and it spreads to the bloodstream. Like if you get
that, almost
cut,
happened
folks,
to me one time. I had to go to the hospital. I had like the black line going up my ankle.
Yeah, that's bad.
Yeah, and I was 14. Yeah, it was really bad. My mom was like screaming and like sobbing the whole way to the hospital that they were gonna cut my foot off. But I still have it. Okay. This one could have.
Abby would think that was going to happen.
She did. She was freaking out. I'll never forget it. She was screaming. Okay. This one could have simply been my subconscious, but a voice was so distinct and scary that I'm including it. When my maternal grandfather was nearing the end of his life, I was woken up one morning by a deep mocking voice asking, "Have you visited your grandfather lately?" I said I hadn't. The voice then said, "Well, too late," and laughed. Needless to say, I went to visit Grandpa a couple days later, and he died shortly after that. Spooky.
Too late and then laughed. That's terrible.
It's probably like his like brother who had died, like being the jerk or something.
Yeah, jerk brothers.
I don't know. That's creepy, though. I have dreams before people die. So does my mom. And my dad actually had one, too, before his father died. And this is actually the anniversary of my grandfather's passing. My dad had a dream about that. Typically, my mother and I, we dream about people passing a lot. Mm-hmm. And our cousin Rachel is the same way. Mm-hmm. Good story.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. That was a great story.
Thanks, Amy. Amy has some good stories for next week, too.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, gosh, cool.
Some really good stories.
We got anything else?
No. Do we?
I don't think so.
Oh, I don't think so. Beth and I are driving to New York tomorrow, and I'm going to play my favorite spooky podcast the whole ride.
Amelia's going to bring her headphones. Okay, yeah. So we're going to be driving down to New York tomorrow, and then we'll be driving home from New York on Sunday. So perhaps Amelia will put out an all call for people to like send their questions, right? Things that you want to know.
Do you mean Amelia will be doing a Facebook Live?
Maybe.
In the passenger seat? I know she will. She's already planned it.
Oh, okay. But remember when we went up and did the Wyndham restaurant in New Hampshire? And we like took all the listener questions just about like random stuff about us?
Yeah.
And then we recorded answers in the car while we were driving?
Yeah, that was fun.
That was fun. By all means, send out a thing and I'll call for people to ask us questions. And then next week we'll have answers to your questions.
Or we'll do it Facebook Live, baby.
Hey, so you should check out our website, ghosthuntinginnewengland.com. It has been recently updated. It's not totally up to date, but there is some information. You can check us out on all of the social medias. We are on the Twitter. That's Amelia's new favorite right now, ghosthuntingne. We are on Facebook and Instagram, ghosthuntinginnewengland. You can email us, ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com, with your drive-by ghostings, which if you're new, a drive-by ghosting is just merely your own story about a little ghost encounter that you had. If you want to send it to us in an audio file, please keep it under 1 minute, 3 minutes.
3 minutes. I say 3 minutes.
Under 3 minutes. You know, we can always edit it up for you as well if it's, you know, kind of rambling or anything like that. So
we will. Don't worry.
Yeah, and don't worry, we ramble plenty too.
Oh, we have something else exciting just here at the end. Beth and I are both vaccinated, so we can start going ghost hunting again. We haven't been ghost hunting in forever.
I know. Last place was the USS Salem last year.
Yeah.
Last summer. So yeah, we could if other people will let us come. That's really what we're running into, that places are just like, no, we're not having the public in yet. And when you're in a restaurant and you ask to be seated outdoor, don't complain that it's cold. You ask to be outside. If you want to be in climate control, just ask to sit inside. And please don't ever ask somebody to change the temperature in the restaurant. Like,
I was just going to say that. If you are the type of person who sits in a restaurant and asks them to adjust the temperature,
stay home.
Just bring a fan.
And a sweater. Bring a pair of boots and flip-flops.
And a tankini.
Bring yourself some mittens. Keep your face mask on. And as always,
happy hunting.